Hare Krishna. This morning, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, and there was Hiranyakashipu who's preaching to his family about the passing of his brother Hiranyaksha and how they should see everything as part of greater plan of divine fate, and how ultimately the soul is immortal and never dies. Amazing to hear that from the lips of demon, super demon. In fact, just yesterday I was listening to a tape where Prabhupada was again quoting one of his favorite Prabhupadisms and calling democracy demon crazy, and the Prabhupada went a little further than that. He said that demon and crazy, said it that previously the demons were at least intelligent, but now the leaders are both demons and they're crazy, both, so demon crazy. And anyway, here's an example. Hiranyakashipu is quite learned in scriptural knowledge. But it was about the ladies, wives, excuse me, of a king who had fallen in battle. And South Indian lay and king, and they were grieving over him. Srila Prabhupada in the purport was talking about the sati rite, although there he called it, I think it was saha martyam, which means to die along with, dying along with the husband. If the wife had husband had passed away, then the cremation is a standard method of disposing of the body in India, of course. And then the wife could voluntarily enter the fire. And whereas it wasn't compulsory, but it was allowed. Which is interesting. It reflects the depth of attachment that women had for their husbands, that the pain of separation was not as great as the pain of being burnt alive, because they were alive when they stepped into the fire. And then Srila Prabhupada gives him an example that he says even 50 years ago, which now was more like 80 years ago, he witnessed or he knew a doctor who had died, and his wife felt such separation that she also was carried along to the funeral pyre, and she left her body along with her husband. Generally, it's called sati, right? Sati also gave up her body voluntarily like that. It wasn't because Lord Shiva had left his body, but because he was so badly treated by her father that she didn't want to have anything to do with the body that came from her father. Anyhow, and that was then called the sati, right? And that was current even during the time of the English Raj, but it became outlawed when women were starting to be forced into that type of practice, which is really a horrible thing to do. Why would a family force their daughter-in-law to adopt the sati rite because forcibly tie to the stake and burn him, because they didn't want the financial burden of having to maintain the wife, because the wife also in Vedic culture then couldn't marry. I mean, they wouldn't marry because they couldn't conceive of having to live with another man. They'd rather live with no man than another man other than their husband. Anyway, that was stopped. It was one of the things that really added to the fire, or added validity to people's criticism of the caste, what they call the caste system, the Varnashram system. And these wives, in their lament, how they were lamenting, now who will take care of us, who will take care of the citizens, what will we do, where will we go, etc., etc. It's quite obvious that they're self-motivated, which often is the case when people lament over someone else as painfully as they may lament, ultimately. Well, as John Donne says, although he meant it in a different context, he says, "Do not ask for who the bell tolls, it tolls for thee." So people lament for themselves, for their own loss. Who will take care of me now? Who will I be able to love? Or who will love me? But however you look at it, it's a selfish approach. It's certainly not the selfless approach of real love or pure love for Krishna, that is. And the type of love that people have for each other based on their spiritual identity, which, in which case, devotees, at least hopefully, devotees, may express that they miss each other because now they won't be able to help each other in serving Krishna, but are equally in a blissful state of utsava, because they recognize that the deceased is now with Krishna, or being able to serve Krishna under better circumstances in the future. So in that light, we were reading a couple of verses in which Krishna is talking about the Varnashram system, which is very instructive, and there are two analogies that Krishna gives that are extremely valuable. Before I mention them, one thing to note is that wherever Varnashram is described, the role and the meditation of a grihastha is always one of someone who's realizing his duty to become detached from family, from home, from children, and so on. Not someone who's oblivious to the passing of the years and is just absorbed in the bliss of matrimony. The example is that, for instance, of a river. When you see a river flow, you see it flowing in one direction. But very often there's a countercurrent. That countercurrent is beneath the surface and it goes in the other direction. So that's somewhat like what grihastha life is meant to be. Although in one direction there's obviously an exhibition and feeling of affection for children and wives and people you live with. How can you not become attached to someone you live with for who knows how long, 25, 30, 40 years. On the other hand, beneath the surface, by the practice of devotional service, by regularly studying Srimad Bhagavatam and associating with sadhus, there should also be a proportional detachment taking place, realizing that all of these people who I'm living with, and now here are the two examples that Krishna gives. He gives one that family life is just like travelers meeting together. It's like when travelers are on the road and they meet together in an inn, and they get to know each other, they dine with each other, they speak, they share some experiences and so on. But ultimately in the morning, everyone moves on their own journey. So beautiful example. So similarly, we're also like that. We're here in this material world, but ultimately we're just together for a little while, and then we continue on our journey, hopefully back to Krishna. And the other is that in the meantime, while one is living with these other travelers, then he should see his live in his house as a guest. Now that's an extraordinary concept. You live in your house as a guest. When you go to someone's home, you're actually conscious that everything is theirs. You don't think yourself a proprietor of anything. You don't have any real rights. You're just there. You eat whatever they put on the table. You avail yourself of whatever seating facilities there are, and that's it. No more. And you don't. You're satisfied. You don't ask for more than what you see. So Krishna gives this wonderful example of how grihasthas just feel like guests in their own home. And means that they act like that as well. Two very useful analogies for grihasthas to both contemplate and practice. And what to speak of, obviously, for brahmacharis and sannyasis, if this is the bar for grihasthas, then we should really study and see, you know, just what Krishna's expectation is of brahmacharis, brahmacharinis, sannyasis, vanaprasthas. Hare Krishna.